You know what it is? I'll tell you what it is. It's anti-Italian discrimination.
Thinking about the last episode, especially in the message, the parallels in Lion of the Desert to the Palestinians and Israel are stark. I mean, amazing. You know, Mustafa Akkad tried to have the message made in Hollywood first, right? And tried to garner money for the film to be made in Hollywood. And I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, Hollywood's full of Jews, but they are, you know, a powerful polity within American media and film, right? And the idea of, especially at that time, right, late 60s and you know, the Seven-Day War and stuff, the idea of Hollywood producing and financing a film about Islam and about the Prophet seems to probably be at a particularly bad time, right, for American filmmaking.
It makes sense for Akkad to go for it, though, because, I mean, biblical epics were being churned out like crazy at that point in time in Hollywood. Charlton Heston famously portraying, like, Moses with the Ten Commandments.
I will argue against that, because what makes this interesting is that during the 67 war and the real war there was between Nasser and Israel. So the enemy, the Hollywood's enemy, wasn't Islam. It was pan-Arabism and communism. So, like, if anything, I'm surprised Hollywood didn't sign on to a movie like The Message, because at that point, U.S. policy was to empower Muslims against the communists. So, like, the Gulf states were close allies with the Americans, because the Gulf states were advertising a pan-Islamic view of the region versus a pan-Arabist view.
I would say if they had waited two more years, I believe that was when the Soviets officially rolled into Afghanistan, that would have been, like, the time to pitch that movie to Hollywood.
Right? Yes, 70. 79 was the 79. Christmas of 79.
That would have been
the movie was released in 76, I believe. So if they waited 3 years,
I see what you mean.
If they waited 3 years, fucking every dickhead in Hollywood would be spending like $10 billion on a movie about The Message.
True.
The Message would have ended with this movie is dedicated to the brave Mujahideen.
Yes. Oh yeah, and Abu Sufyan would be wearing an Ukshanka with a fucking hammer and sickle on it and executing Muslims.
Talking about the communalism of the Kaaba and how all religions are respected there, or something like that.
The decadent communist of
both effeminate communists and also like aggressive and kills everyone, and you know, like he'd be like and the Muslims would be portrayed in the same way they are in The Message, like austere, simple, eat simple foods. The Abu Sufyan would be like drinking vodka and being like
traditional dancing, they would just be doing that like Russian dance.
eating pickles and shooting vodka. We're here, we're back, it's a week later for you guys, it's been 15 minutes for us. We're back to talk about, for me, the best anti-Italian propaganda film since The Passion of the Christ in Lion of the Desert.
It's so good. It's so good. It is banned in Italy. Yeah, it was banned by Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti.
Mm-hmm. Andreotti. I mean, yeah, listen to some Radio Warner episodes about Italy to find out more about Andreotti and the legacy of the Christian Democrats in Italy. He's probably the most important prime minister in post-war Italy. Andreotti.
I'd argue so, yeah.
So I mean, one sign that your propaganda is good is that the people you criticize literally ban it from being aired in their country. So if you want to shit on the Italians, if you want to learn about Italian fascism, by the way, which is, I should say before we start, Italian fascism, especially in the United States, has a kind of lower status than both German Nazism and even Imperial Japanese fascism, if you call it that. I mean, we can get into arguments about whether it's true fascism or whether it's something else entirely. But, I mean, Mussolini, as an eventual understudy and kind of failure by comparison to Hitler, Italian fascism is oftentimes kind of forgotten. It's relegated to the also in Axis powers category, even less so to Americans, especially than Stalin's activities in the Axis before the turn in the Second World War. And if you want to remember how brutal and fucked up Italian fascism is, Lion of the Desert really gives you that sense. Italian fascism and colonialism, right, broadly speaking, monstrous.
Have any of you watched the movie Captain Corelli's Mandolin?
I have not.
Captain Corelli's what?
Mandolin.
Mandolin.
Mm-mm.
So it stars Nicolas Cage in what is perhaps the most atrocious portrayal of an Italian you'll ever see in your life. He basically goes, "Ah, bambina!" at every scene you see him in.
Counterpoint, Jared Leto in House of Gucci is probably the like
fair, most, fair. I watched this before House of Gucci came out, so fair. And Christian Bale rivals Nicolas Cage as the worst portrayal of a Greek you'll ever see. So basically the movie is about Captain Corelli, this fictional, or I think he's fictional, I don't know for sure, Italian colonel who leads an Italian detachment during their war in Greece and their occupation in Greece. And to your point, Alec, about the Nazis being seen as the superior evil, whereas the Italians are at best comic relief in the American mind, I watched Captain Corelli's My Little with my Italian ex. She's Italian, not that, like, you know, fucking, you know, hey, I'm walking over here Italian. No, she's like from Liguria. And she was telling me how when her family went to Greece for a vacation a while ago, like this was like 80s, like in the 70s, and so the memories of Italian presence in Greece were fresh. And the Greeks were actually okay with the Italians because, and I don't know if she was like exaggerating this or true, but I've heard similar things from other people, including, I believe, Annibale mentions this in Radio Warner. The Italian occupation of Greece was a lot more light touched in the sense that because after the Italian surrender, the Germans replaced the Italians. So in the Greek history, the comparison is between the Italians and the Germans. And the brutality of the Germans retroactively made the Italians look really good, because even though the Italians were somewhat brutal, they were like seen as okay. They left people alone versus the sort of horrific psychosis of the German fascism, German Nazism. So when we watched with me and my ex, he was telling me how like the Greeks were like fairly okay with Italians and didn't really care about the Italian occupation because fascism was seen as less harmful than Nazism. Lion of the Desert is the perfect antidote to Captain Corelli's Mandolin, whereas Captain Corelli's Mandolin portrays that occupation, Italian occupation of Greece, as like relatively harmless, okay, whatever. The Lion of the Desert shows how brutal Italians were to people they didn't consider as white. They saw the Greeks as like part of the Greco-Roman sort of like, you know, whereas the Libyans, and then I don't know if there's any movies about the Italian war in Abyssinia. Lion of the Desert, in showing what Italians, how Italians acted as a colonial enterprise, an explicitly colonial enterprise against an explicitly non-European peoples, shows how psychotic fascism was, really. Like, it really shows the bloodthirst of fascism.
And it underlines their brand of fascism, right? Which, instead of this, you know, the modernist, almost invented out of whole cloth mythos of Nazism, there's a really pure strain hearkening back to the fallen empire of the Romans,
Rome,
right? And their relationship to the Greeks, for instance, and their relationship to North Africa, right? Which is explicitly said multiple times in this film.
Graziani, the amount of scenes where Graziani, or even like the scenes with Mussolini, where he's walking down the longest hallway you've ever seen in your life, and the only things you see are statues of Caesar and Augustus, like just like every fucking thing is Caesar and Augustus, and you're like, oh yeah, they want to, this is Rome for them. Mussolini thinks he's Augustus.
Mussolini's like office with those maps of the world, and then the maps of the Mediterranean. Of old Rome, right?
Yeah. Mare Nostrum. They wanted Mare Nostrum. Yeah.
They even
which, speaking of Mussolini, salute to Rod Steiger, because if I had a nickel every time Rod Steiger played Mussolini in a movie, I'd have two nickels, which is surprisingly a number of nickels.
The only problem, he's too fucking tall, right? Mussolini, short devil.
He is tall, but did you catch, I don't know how they did it on the set, like I don't know whether they specifically did this deliberately or whether it was just an error. Did you catch in the initial scene when Steiger's Mussolini walks into the office and sits on the chair and his legs aren't touching the floor?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's like his legs are like there's like this much of a gap like between his legs on the floor. It's like a small gap, but you can see his legs dangling, and I'm like, Akkad, you're doing it again.
Respect.
I did see that Rod Steiger's head was for this movie was shaved by Mussolini's old barber. So there's a little connection there. A bit of method acting.
Authenticity.
We gotta bring the boy back.
Yeah, and luckily one thing I also found about this film is that Mussolini was so obsessed with propaganda and, you know, getting everything on film that the opening shot of this movie was thanks to Mussolini's archiving of like footage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll talk about it later, but the use of historical footage in this film is particularly poignant. It's not overly used. It's just used to really hammer home the brutality of the concentration camps, which at the end is, you know, the kind of culmination of the horror of the film. And in the first series of scenes, as a kind of descriptive element to show the subjugation of Libya and Cyrenaica, yeah, under the early 20th century Italian control. Just footage of people being hanged and corralled, yeah, by Italian soldiers.
And like the public spectacle of the hanging. So like you'll see the hanging and you'll see like a crowd in the background. And it's meant to show that like you were supposed to, like if you were a Libyan, you were made to look at your compatriots being hanged as an example to you, you know?
If you're at all studied in the history of the Nazi Party and of the Holocaust, you might be aware that the Nazis learned a lot of things from a lot of people. Even mentioned in some of those is how much they learned from the Italians, for instance, right? The British, the Americans, but also the Italians. This film is exactly that, right? The concentration of do we want to call them Bedouins? They're called Bedouins in the film, but it's really the Senussi, right?
The Senussi,
the Senussi order of Libyan pastoralists in mostly southeast Libya, right? In Cyrenaica. These are places, these concentration camps were visited explicitly by Goering, right? Himmler, during this period, comes to Italian Cyrenaica, Italian Libya, to witness the genocide of the Senussi people.
To the point of, you know, concentrations, and, you know, a lot has been said about how the first concentration camps were the British in the Boer War, and then obviously the Germans practiced a similar approach in Namibia. I think it's important to also highlight that fascism came to power before Nazism. So to your point about Goering visiting the camps, at that point, the Nazis saw fascism as the model to emulate because it came first. And it was showing, it was paving the path for the Nazis. I keep going back to that. I think it's Amy Cesare who says, like, the real crime of Nazism was bringing colonial violence back home to the metropole. To the Italians, like, they didn't really do concentration camps in Europe and Greece and Albania the same way they would do it in Libya. But, like, the Germans took that example as it was being done already. So, in that sense, the Amy Cesare quote is like, it's already being done. It's just now done to people that you could see and, you know, read about.
Oh, I mean, and the example is direct. You have a subjugated population that's problematic. What do you do with them? And the Germans look at this and say, well, I mean, we're going to be doing colonialism in Europe. We're going to be settling, especially Eastern Europe. And these are going to be, as in the past, these are going to be subjugated and problematic ethnic groups. What do you do with this? How do you colonize, you know, to Italians colonizing Libya to a lesser extent than the Nazi dream of colonizing, you know, all of Poland and perhaps all of the Slavic lands with Germanic peoples, but an entirely similar goal with a similar use case.
Yeah, one of the early scenes, Mussolini is telling, like you know, in terms of complaining about the fucking insurgency, Mussolini is like, lira for lira, the peasants we sent to Libya to colonize it is as expensive as setting them up in the Grand Hotel in Rome. He's like, it's so expensive because of the fucking insurgency. But like, yeah, the whole point is sending southern peasants from Italy to like colonize, like actively settle on the land that is they're supposed to supplant the local population. And to your point about models and previous examples, they just ripped that off straight from the French in Algeria. The French did it first, and they're doing it, trying to do the same thing in Libya.
And you almost get an amazing sense that almost the goal of Italian Libya is nakedly a competition game of prestige with like other European colonial powers, right? I mean, it's almost it's stated by Graziani or by Mussolini. I can't remember, right? Like, if France can have its Libya, if Britain can have its, I can't remember what the example was.
If South Spain Africa can have Morocco, Congo. If England can have Egypt,
Italy has as much right here as anybody else.
England has a right to Egypt, France to Tunisia, Algeria, Spain to Morocco, but none of them have our pedigree. We have hundreds of years of right here.
Then, you know, Italy.
Then we shall have Libya, right? And it's a question because the colonization of Libya historically predates even like the discovery of oil in Libya. So this is clearly something they want for a different reason. What does Libya produce that they want? Well, it produces a prestige of having a colony, right?
Yeah, it's isn't it just about like retaking what was once considered the Roman Empire, just like the northern
and critically a part of the Roman Empire that nobody else controls yet, right? At the moment, right? That you can take from not another European power but the Turks, right? So the Italo-Turkish War kicks off this colonization scheme,
which is so funny because when it, like, it wasn't considered an essential part of the Roman Empire. Like Egypt was very important for the Roman Empire, but the British were controlling Egypt, and Italy realized can't fucking beat the British. So it's like, we'll just pick on these fucking tribesmen and the Turks. Like, the Turks are easy picking at this point.
If anything, for the Romans, it was Tunisia, but I mean, crushed Carthage and salted the lands. And then basically a century or two later, set it up as kind of a retirement home for old soldiers. Right. And that's basically that portion of North Africa, because the coast is, you know, it's not that it's inhospitable, but inhospitable to the kind of Roman way of life, right? Like having a big latifundia or whatever, right, as a retired soldier, or a farm, well watered so that you can grow grapes for your wine and stuff. There's a very small portion of North Africa that can really create that kind of lifestyle for you, you know, as opposed to Egypt with its riches or other parts of the Levant, for instance.
This is all about glory for Italy.
I was going to say, I didn't know a lot of Libya looked like this. There's a lot of verdant parts of Libya I was really surprised to see.
Yeah, I mean, Akkad does this as well. He does this worse. He's worse in The Message. But, like, to be fair, Mecca, and Medina in particular, more than Mecca. Mecca was more mercantile, but Medina was an oasis. Like, its primary economic activity was agriculture of date palms and barley. And Libya, like, there are various spots, oases, where there's aquifers and enough rain that the aquifers get refilled, that it can, not the same intensive agriculture as, like, river deltas, but, like, it is fairly, you could get food out of it. People know how to eat. Like, it's not the Sahara, which is a lot of movies fall into the trap of making every period piece look like it's filmed in the Sahara, which is really annoying. But in this movie, he does really well in portraying, like, enough green that you're like, oh yeah, people can eat and drink here.
So just as a little bit of a refresher, since it has been a week for our listeners, Lion of the Desert was the movie that was directed by Mustafa Akkad in exchange for Muammar Gaddafi funding The Message. So this is the movie that, like we said last week, this is the one he has to do for the film industry so that he could do The Message. And this is about what we've just been talking about, the Italian colonization of Libya and the brave Libyan people who fought against that colonization. And they were led by Omar Mukhtar. I got to say, while The Message had me being like, oh, I kind of want to like go to Barnes & Noble and look at the Quran, this movie had me tearing up at the end. And I went to my partner, I was like, the West has just like completely fucked Africa and the Arab world, and like the chickens need to come home to roost, babe. This is horrible.
If The Message makes you want to convert to Islam, Lion of the Desert makes you a Maoist third worldist.
Both of these films are written by a guy named Harry Craig, who is an Irishman. He's very well known for Lion of the Desert. He wrote a couple other films, but I thought it particularly poignant that the English writer for a film basically about decolonization, about the horrors of colonialism, is written by an Irishman, a particular kind of English speaker that has a very close affinity and understanding for the brutality of European colonialism, transposed here on to Libya, right? Or I don't know if you could describe the Quraysh as you know, another oppressive structure in The Message. But this is a particularly effective anti-colonial film, is striking given who writes it.
Yeah, Harry Craig. Yeah, I knew he was Irish. I also knew he wrote a book about Bilal, which is why Bilal is portrayed the way he is in The Message. Because Craig really focused a lot on Bilal, because he had this idea of, like, you know, like you say, decolonization through the eyes of, like, oppressor and oppressed, like, you know, enslaved and enslaver. But I think between the two, he really goes hard on in terms of, like, the explicit colonial elements in Lion of the Desert. His writing is really interesting, because in The Message, he's like doing explicitly like old Arabic story into English. Whereas Lion of the Desert, what I thought was funny was, like, both the Italians and the Senussi speak English, but they understand one another, where it's like, There's no like, you know, I mean, obviously, like, I didn't expect this to happen in 1979 or whatever it was filmed. Like, I didn't like, this isn't like 2024. They're not filming Shogun, right? Whereas Shogun, you know, you brought Shogun up in the first episode, Connor, and I wanted to bring it back, because one of the whole contrites of Shogun is that the whole experiment is the white guy needs translators everywhere he goes, which is why the certain characters in Shogun, their roles are translators. That's why they're there. They translate white guy into Japanese and Japanese into white guy. Granted, he's originally Portuguese, or he's in the books he's English. Either way, is the point is that they're supposed to translate Japanese to Portuguese. He speaks Portuguese. He speaks Portuguese back to them. They translate to Japanese. In Lion in the Desert, there's no translation. Like the Senussiites and the Italians, whatever, they're in a scene together. They're speaking English at one another. But that's the idea. What you're supposed to understand as a viewer is like they just understand each other, period. There's no question of why the fuck would these guys know Italian and why the fuck would these guys know Arabic?
You know, that was a production decision that I think worked. I mean, this movie's three hours long. You could double it by just like repeating the dialogue.
Having translations, yeah. But yeah, I thought Harry Craig did a good job writing the English, script. It's fairly tight script. It's spoken very well. Again, he goes really hard on the decolonial elements. Anthony Quinn basically reprises his role just in a different timepiece. Yeah,
that's interesting. Omar Mukhtar and Hamza are almost two peas in a pod, right? It's One is a translation of the other almost directly.
One thing I really liked about Quinn's portrayal of Mukhtar, the first time we see Mukhtar, he's giving a sermon to these little boys that are just like, you know, white knuckling it because they see something's going on in the town square and they're like, oh my God, I want to go play. And he's just like, all right, go on, have some fun. Like, he's so gregarious and charming. He's very unassuming. He loves everyone he comes into contact with. And he's also like the leader of a guerrilla army.
He's austere. Yeah. You know, he's kind and
that's
thoughtful.
Isn't that a classic trope though in movies? Like, if you want to show that the leader of a guerrilla army is morally good, he's good with kids. You have to show a scene where he's like either playing with kids or like gruff exterior, but internally very soft with kids. And like, there's always a scene where like they're good with kids. You know.
Yeah, there's a scene where a woman's husband, she finds out her husband died in battle. He's talking to her and her son. He gives the son the father's Quran, and he pulls the wife aside and says, hey, you can cry, but don't cry too much in front of him. Why don't you go cry in the tent, and I'll go play with your kid. Yeah, he's just the kindest guy on the planet.
Yeah. The scenes with the child playing with his glasses and then how that comes full circle is like really touching. It's such a good choice.
The way Akkad portrays the message is by showing different historical characters interacting with Muhammad and being convinced by Muhammad. The way Akkad portrays how Omar Mukhtar is an appealing religious figure and charismatic is through that one kid alone, Ali. Like, you see him in the beginning playing with the glasses, and then you see him later in the camps, the concentration camps, and like, he's there as the way he's, I don't want to say an audience stand-in because he's a child, but he's supposed to convince us why Omar al-Mukhtar was so appealing to Libyans to fight against colonialism. And also, he's there to show, not tell, even though they do both, they show and tell. The classic thing that he says, and Omar al-Mukhtar says in the end, where he's like, I'll die, but the next generation will fight, and the generation after that will fight, and the generation after that will fight. And, you know, he's telling Graziani this in their final meeting before he gets hanged. He's like, you can kill me, but generations will continue to fight until you're out of here. And the child is supposed to represent that continuity into the next generation of fighting.
A prophetic movie about counterinsurgency warfare, you know, I mean, the history of the United States is that, I guess, people keep telling this story and people keep learning this lesson and nobody ever listens.
Yeah. We're doing this recording just after a report came out being like, Hamas is stronger today than it was on October 7th, because every child who's lost a parent right now is basically like, yeah, I'm going to sign up. Well, I've got nothing to lose. Yeah, fuck it. Fuck the Israelis. I'm going to
Or Yemen. I mean, Christ. We're out of ammo. We've been shelling the Yemenis for a couple months now, and they show no signs of being diminished in their power at all. If anything, everybody's rallying around them because bombs keep dropping again, right?
One day we'll probably do an episode on that Brad Pitt movie War Machine and how counterinsurgency. Oh no, you don't want to do that?
I
just think it's a great movie of just like counterinsurgency and its failings.
It's a lib movie about why is it that we keep screwing up and we can't seem to do anything right. But then, like, the culmination of the film, it just kind of throws its hands up and says, oh, you know, politics is complicated, you know, maybe someday we'll fight a war where we're actually competent, but we don't learn any lessons, and you know, who's really, who can really say who's to blame for that?
Yeah. It's also a movie about Obama just like going through generals like bags of Cheetos. It's very, very, very fun.
It's got a great portrayal of the prime minister of Afghanistan.
Hamid Karzai?
Karzai, kind of, you know, welcoming this new American general into his office and, you know.
Oh, I'm just looking at the last... page. It's Ben Kingsley. Ben Kingsley. Hell yes.
He's like, I got the speech from the last five guys. And, you know, Brad Pitt stands up and he says, well, this time's going to be different for sure. And he goes, yeah. sure. That's what all of you say. Sure. You know, call me anytime. I'm in my office, you know?
Oh, my God. Ben Kingsley has the face of Karzai as well. They look like identical.
For a second, I was like, they got Karzai in this movie? And I was like, wait, no, stop.
Oh, my God. They got Gandhi in this movie. Oh, wait.
Well, that's something I was surprised. I'm surprised Gaddafi didn't push for a role in the movie, In Line in the Desert. He's like, can you make me an extra or something? It would be so sick. It would be so cool.
So let's get into this movie, because it is, you know, we did a lot of setting up like the conflict of this movie and why the events of this movie happen. Some of the things that were really funny is kind of how on the nose it can be about how cruel the Italians are. One of which, Alec, to your point earlier, there's a line of like, we just need to concentrate the Libyans, like just straight up.
Yes, I love that line.
And a line that like I wrote down was like, do I even need to tell you that we are not abiding by the Geneva Convention? I'm like, good Lord, it's not. I mean,
it's very, very clear that the Italians are not playing by their own rules. The Europeans are liars. They invent all this shit. They're using chemical warfare later.
Yeah.
We need to concentrate. That line killed me. I was off the fucking roof dying. We need to, how do you say, concentrate them? What if we had our flag with a bundle of sticks and there's an axe in that bundle?
Yeah, the flag of the fascists is very prominently displayed.
Yeah, the fascists is on helmets everywhere. Yeah. I mean, they don't let you forget.
They also straight up say, like, in regards to Libya, a character asks, what can you get for it? And I believe the general says, glory for Rome. That's it. Yes. He doesn't name any resources, just glory for Rome, man. Which just really, I did walk away with this from this movie with a sense that you just got to let the past die sometimes. Like, really clinging on to past glory is what leads to some pretty horrible shit in human history. So.
Well, it's also a contrast to, like, Nazism, because Nazism explicitly saw its expansion east in terms of resources, oil, farmland, a space to, like, you know, export settlers, etc. Whereas the Italian obsession with the Mediterranean was purely, like the fuck, again, the scenes where Mussolini is walking, like, there's this, like, 3 minutes and just walking up a hallway and just statues of Augustus, Caesar, Trajan, Aurelian, like all these different emperors. And you're like, oh, he just wants to be Roman. That's all that there's all there is to it. And like, yeah, like this is before the discovery of oil in Libya. Oil has been discovered in the Caucasus, which is why the Nazis are pushing east. Oil has been discovered in Arabian Peninsula, which is why the British are so paranoid about Italian or German advance eastwards in North Africa, because they're afraid of threatening their oil supplies. But like, Libya wasn't known for oil then. It had some agriculture, but not enough to warrant a full-scale invasion. All they wanted was glory for Rome.
So what this movie does really well is it portrays how Libyan guerrilla fighters push back against this Italian occupation and some absolutely incredible and jaw-dropping action scenes. It is a fucking crime that Akkad was not recruited by Hollywood to actually direct some action movies of this era. Because Alec, one of the things that we had talked about in our pre-production of this was Hollywood needs to go back to this kind of action movie. We need to go back to squibs. We need to go back to lots of extras. Get rid of the CGI crap. Like, this is how movies should be made.
It's shocking to watch this film that's made in Libya, right? Outside of the circle of the Hollywood lots, right? I mean, this, I assume in part, right, that these two films are created on the ground in Libya that doesn't have its own, you know, film studio structure. And, you know, oil money spends pretty well, right? Let's not kid
Gaddafi,
ourselves.
Gaddafi spent $35 million US dollars on this movie alone.
Well, but I mean, if you want to create epics, right, that's what it costs.
Right.
But to do this in a place like Libya and to have it come across so, like, epically, like, so cleanly, this is such a breath of fresh air compared to almost anything that gets made nowadays, right? The budget is used on real physical. I mean, look, the message has a lot of cool action scenes, but the confines of that movie are much smaller. The battles are smaller. The you know, one of my gripes maybe about the message of, out of all of them is the battles, while they look, you know, kind of impressive from far away, once you get up close, the swords are obviously props, right? The armor is just like a joke, right? Whenever everybody's drawing their bows, right? It's just, it's very kind of fake, chinchy kind of TV Hollywood stuff. The Lion of the Desert is all out awesome. I mean, they're rolling around in real, like, Fiat. I don't know if they're reconstructions or if they just had these lying around, like real Fiat tanks, right, from the era. There's all kinds of scenes on horses, because Omar Mukhtar is if anything, right, a cavalry commander.
Yeah.
And horses falling, explosions, right? And that kind of stuff is just too costly and dangerous and troublesome to make nowadays. I mean, when they say epic war film, it really feels epic.
The I agree with your criticism of the message, Alec. Like, the battle scenes do feel chintzy, and I think part of it is because it's swords instead of, like, guns. So, like, and the swords look very cheap when it comes up close. Like, it looks very, very proppy and rely heavily on soundtrack for, like ching, ching, ching of swords. Yeah. But Lion in the Desert, because it's like gunpowder movie, it's rifles and stuff, like it's a lot more explosions, it's a lot more like guys on horseback firing those old rifles against like machine guns. So sick. To your point,
artillery, Connor, yeah, machine
gun. My political campaign, if I ever ran for US president, I will do two things when I'm the first day in office. Mandatory squibs. Every action movie needs to use squibs again.
Yes.
On pain of like 10 years in Guantanamo if you don't do the squibs. The second thing is that we will reinstate conscription, but for service industry and for being extras in movies. You will be gang pressed into becoming an extra in a like action movie with another like 200 other people.
Yes.
Like, we need that.
I do agree. We do need 2 years mandatory service industry service so you can learn how to be a fucking human being.
Like you need to be like gang pressed at KFC prior for like a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you're in the reserves, the conscription reserves, where you get called up to like become an extra. Because fucking like the movies today, like you're right. Like I remember like all the Marvel slop, obviously, but also other action movies where like there's all of this CGI stuff, but there's not really a sense of scale in terms of people in a battle. Yes. Like this is supposed to, I'm watching a movie that's supposed to be a war between two sides. I want to see like hundreds of people falling and dying and fucking fighting each other. There's scenes in Lion in the Desert where like a cavalry guy will be charging and jumps off horseback to like take out two Italians.
Amazing.
And like just beats them. Yeah,
the sense of scale, especially in the scene where the invading regiment surrounds and besieges, they take this oasis in the desert, and there are these shots from a hilltop looking down on this Italian regiment, and the sense of scale, the enormity of the desert behind them, and the armor advancing, and then the setup of the artillery firing is just monumental. It just doesn't feel like movies do nowadays, you know? It feels big and expansive.
There's a big difference between The Two Towers, the Peter Jackson film, and then The Battle of Five Armies. Like, The Two Towers, you see actual people. To this day, you watch and you're like, oh, shit, this is super impressive. And with Battle of Five Armies, you can tell this is all CGI. And that scene that you're talking about, like, I believe it's the bridge scene. You even get, and I'm going to find it in the movie, and I'm going to clip it in here, but you get what I like to call the Arab Wilhelm scream, where a guy falls off the bridge and his scream is very much like, oh, this is like old movies. Like, I don't even know when the last time I heard a Wilhelm scream in a movie, and this is the closest I got to it. It's like, this is incredible.
Which, to your point, Connor, again, Peter Jackson, every one of Lord of the Rings movies, there's a Wilhelm scream. Not in Battle of Five Armies, but in Helm's Deep, there's a scene where a guy falls off a fucking the walls. Yeah. It's like, and it's like, yes, movies are back, baby. Let's go.
Connor finished Lion of the Desert before me and sent me a message about the Wilhelm scream. And I remember when it happened. I was like, oh, there it is.
Law
number three, when I become Caliph of America, every movie should have a Wilhelm scream. I don't care. I don't care if it's a fucking romance. I don't care if it's a comedy. There needs to be a Wilhelm scream.
Hold on.
Remaking When Harry Met Sally, where she just did the Wilhelm scream in the diner instead. So one thing that this movie, like we're saying right now, this movie, the action really captures the scale of these kind of guerrilla guerrilla warfare and the disparities between the two armies and how successful a guerrilla army can be when your opponents are following, you know, rules of engagement, so to speak. But what this movie also does really well, and this is why it's so effective, its propaganda, it really captures the horrors of not just war, but colonization. And specifically, I want to talk about that tank scene where the Italians are just rolling through and just shooting people who are down on the ground. Like, they are taking no prisoners. I don't believe a single prisoner is taken in this movie, with the exception of Omar Mukhtar, but everyone else is just killed.
One interesting thing they do, and they do this in the message as well, is contrast, right? So, like, the Italians never take prisoners. They're shooting people on sight. And then there's that one scene when Omar's band surround the young Italian, like the really young Italian officer, and he gives them back his flag, and he's like, we don't shoot prisoners. They do it, but we don't do it to them. And it's like, come on, man. Like, obviously, like, you're supposed to, like, root for the good guys, but, like, clearly the fucking Senussis were executing prisoners as well, as they would be, because the guerrilla army needs to move fast. They're not going to be able to carry prisoners around. But, like, it's also, like, you know, it goes back to that, like, classic Crutchet of the Earth, Fanon idea that, like, when you're a colonial subject fighting colonialism, it makes monsters out of everyone, because that's what you need to do to fight colonialism. Like, they're treating you like animals, so you're fighting back with whatever you can, but because it's asymmetric warfare, it's brutal. And to your point about the tank scene where they're, like, rolling in, did you guys catch when the kid, Ali, the one we're talking about, like, he falls in front of one, and the mother, like, picks him up and rolls out of the way? Yeah, that's so awesome.
Oh, man, a guy just getting rolled over by a tank, I'm just remembering.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So that scene that you mentioned about, like, giving the Italian flag back, that scene pays off in dividends in two different ways. One, it highlights the propagandist motivations of Italians when Graziani, I believe that's the name. Yeah.
Graziani.
He says that, you know, they gave me back the flag, and he interrupts him. He's like, yes, I have never lost the flag. You are a hero for bringing that flag back home. That young Italian troop, he refuses to even let him say the truth of what actually happened. He's like, lived a lie. I have never failed. Lived a lie. And then that young troop comes back scared, and he's like trying not to shoot anybody in battle. And an Italian soldier just like fucking shoots him in the back. Yeah, so it shows that like any mercy is not only lied about, but any mercy is also heavily punished by from within the Italian ranks. They really show the Italians like these are the most evil people to
again,
ever
as you would if you were subjugating an ethnic population. I mean, the lengths at which that this is an act in a series of campaigns, as they see it, basically for the future of the fascist Italian state and of colonial Italy. Right when he says, I would trade a lifetime of days for the Senussi or the Libyans for a day in the history books of Rome.
Not even the history book. He says, I would trade a lifetime in the history books of the Senussis for a day in a newspaper in Rome.
Yeah.
Like, he would rather be a fucking, like, 6-page article in a newspaper in Rome than, like, 10,000 years in the books of the Senussi.
Because that's the colonial... Wins tiny victory over Livian rebels.
Local general earns a secondary medal, third page, versus, like, you know, because, and you know, the contrast is later in that the end scene, which is again one of Akkad's hallmarks, is, you know, the evil villain reaches a point of contrition where he realizes to some degree that he was wrong, where he's talking with Omar Mukhtar after Mukhtar is being captured, again, spoilers, and he's like, Mukhtar is like, you know, when you Europeans, and I hate this fucking logic, it's kind of stupid, but whatever. He's like, when you Europeans are in dark ages, we Muslims had medicine, we were advancing in medicine and science and whatever. And it's like, okay, man.
You know, Amr, something struck me in watching the message. It struck me that basically the Muslims are doing this and then breaking out of Arabia and conquering the Sassanids 300 years before Polish history even starts. Because Polish history really does start when we convert to Christianity in 966. Before that, we're just a tribe. Maybe if you ask the Germans, they have something written down, something, the king, you know, talked to the Lord of the Poles, and they made this agreement about, you know, this piece of land or vassalhood or whatever. But really, nothing's written right before Christendom, and nobody cares. And that kind of arc of history does matter. It does put things in perspective, I think, for Westerners a little bit. For the Kingdom of Heaven episode, I mean, I took several courses from a about history of the Middle Ages, and part of it was crusades and the contact with the Muslims. And I remember a firsthand account from a diary of a Muslim knight, and it was the first time I'd considered this ever. And the Muslim was not just that, you know, interacting with the crusaders, you know, they're people of the book, but they drink and they're kind of slovenly or whatever. He was shocked that they couldn't read. He was shocked that they were illiterate. Dude, it changed my perspective hugely.
Connor, you mentioned in the previous episode in the message about like Protestantism and stuff. One of the interesting things to me that I really like find fascinating is the Reformation and 30 Years' War. I assume Catholics have like Sunday school and they go to like the kids go there and they learn the Bible or whatever. But to your point, Alec, about reading, that scene in the message where Muhammad says every prisoner after the Battle of Badr will be set free if they can teach 10 Muslims how to read. If you teach 10 Muslims how to read, you'll be set free. And it goes back to what the first verse in the Quran, the first revelation ever revealed to Muhammad by God is read. And Muhammad is like, I can't read. And he's like, read in the name of God who created you. And literacy is like the cornerstone of Islam is literacy. The Quran itself, the word Quran means the recitation, but it means like in a technical sense, that which is read. Islam has this such a heavy emphasis on reading. The Muslim knight you're talking about, whose diary is talking about reading, is because every Muslim is expected to read the Quran. You're taught it in schools and in the mosque. You know, in previous eras, it was you'd go to the local mosque and you would learn how to read the Quran. That's also why there was never really a reformation as a religious schism in Islam, because there was no need to translate the Bible into vernacular, because the Quran, every Muslim reads the Quran. There's no need to like have a priest be that intermediary. There are imams and there are scholars and they're supposed to be more knowledgeable in the scientific sort of like, you know, literature of the Quran in terms of like theories and rules and law and theology. But every Muslim can also read the Quran for themselves. That was the fundamental idea what made Islam Islam. There was no need to be like, you know, well, the peasants can't read the Bible, so we're going to tithe them or whatever.
I presume that that's specifically in line of the desert, that that's an homage that Muslims will understand, right? When Omar Mukhtar is teaching children to read, right?
Yes.
That is a particular, it's not just being a teacher, right? It has a particular religious connotation.
Yes. He's not just teaching them to read, but literacy is transmitted through the Quran because they're doing lessons on the verses of the Quran, which teaches them both reading, classical Arabic, which is a very important aspect of literacy for Arabs. The Quran is often understood by Arabs as like the foundational, in addition to all the other spiritual and religious things, the foundational grammatical text for Arabic. If you want to learn Arabic grammar, you read the Quran first. That's where Arabic grammar is all derived from. Well, like, you know, my dad went to Arabic, like Quranic school every Friday to learn the Quran. His dad went before him, and my mom, her mom, everyone goes to these schools to learn the Quran in Arabic. And the grammar and methodology of Arabic is transmitted through that, which is also why, yes, there are dialects of Arabic now, but it didn't really fracture the way Latin fractured into Italian, French, and Spanish, because there's still that common root is still circulating enough that everyone sort of kind of gets it. The motif of Omar al-Mukhtar being surrounded by kids and teaching them how to read is also like meant to reflect that literacy, the importance of literacy and the importance of translating this to the next generation is in contrast later when he goes to like the Graziani and he's like, when you Europeans are in your dark ages and hovels not cleaning, we were teaching our kids how to read.
And I presume it's symbolic of his tradition and piety and, you know, all the good stuff that makes him an effective resistance leader and somebody to be, you know, whose legend should be propagated, you know,
yes.
maybe by a guy like Gaddafi or maybe by any, you know, like resistive or revolutionary force.
The reason why, in my interpretation, the reason why Mukhtar says that to Graziani is that as solemn as Mukhtar is in that scene, this is a competition of big dicking each other. Like he walks in chains and Graziani is just signing documents like, you made me wait, I'm going to make you wait. I'm like, okay, this is a pissing contest. And then he's just like, yeah, have you seen this? This is a Roman coin that we found in your desert. He's like, yeah, you'll find all kinds of coins and buried under the sands of Libya.
That was so great.
And yeah. They're just trying to dunk on it. I mean, Mukhtar is winning, but they're trying to dunk on each other. And Omar is just mopping the floor with Graziani.
Buried under the sands of Libya is such a good line.
Yeah.
Yes.
Phoenician, Greek, right? Carthaginian coins, lots of them, you know?
Yeah.
All buried under the sands here.
The one thing I would have edited from that script, if I was the writer, I'm not able enough to be the writer, but if I was, it'd be like, many coins are buried under the times of Libya, Carthaginian, Aramaic, Phoenician, Arab, but also many occupiers are buried under the sands of Libya.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would have added that. It would have been such a fucking line.
Specifically left out the Turks, right? Which,
yeah.
I mean, it's not like the Turks really, they got along with the Libyans. They were, right? They had their own conflict with these, you know, subjugated
with the Senussi, Turkish control was of the North African coast was very tenuous for most of its lifetime. Like the Turks never really went past Egypt in terms of directly answering to the Sublime Porte in Istanbul. And even Egypt was like the Mamluks, even though the Mamluks were defeated by the Turks, within 100 years, they were back in charge. The governor that the Ottomans sent would often be like a house prisoner, and the Mamluks would be running things.
Semi-autonomous region, basically.
Yeah, it was just the Ottomans were, the centralization was always, they always turned to the Balkans for centralization. The Arab world was almost left alone.
Well, I mean, they at least speak the same language as you, right? Like, let those Muslims can kind of do their own thing within
reason. Yeah, I mean, the big thing, you're right about the big thing, is really funny because, like, in that you have this competition between Mukhtar and Graziani, but also like what they represent, you know, the colonial subject striving for autonomy and to be recognized as a human being, as an equal, versus the colonizer arguing that certain civilizations are inherently superior to others and therefore have the right to like reassert their control. That's what the Roman coin, to me at least, represented, was like, is some mythological past justification for colonialism, or is the colonial subject to be accepted into the pantheon of humanity as an equal? And, you know, obviously Mukhtar is very, and, you know, Akkad's portrayal of Mukhtar is meant to highlight one side over the other. Like, you know, this is like an anti-colonial movie. But like, the one weakness of that scene to me is that, like, this is not a matter you settle with words. This is a matter you settle with war, and then the negotiations happen afterwards. And that's where the later line comes in, where he's like, you can kill me, but the next generation will fight, and the generation after that will fight, and the generation after that will fight. And, you know, which goes back to what I would have added, was like, there's a lot of dead conquerors under the sands of Libya too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the ending of the film kind of thumbing its nose at Graziani dying in 1955 after being imprisoned.
In prison, yeah.
It doesn't
he was in
quite
prison
speak.
For 4 months, by the way. They left that out.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite speak pretty quick. To the attitude in which he dies, which is well-fed in a fucking villa in Rome.
Yeah,
you know?
And with a figurehead within the Italian neo-fascist party that kicked off.
Yeah.
Still has a massive cult, by the way, among fucking Italian fascists. Yeah.
Which, yeah, that's the problem with watching movies like Lion of the Desert, is like, you're watching it, and then like, in the back of your head, you can't help but think, oh, Maloney's in charge, the Fratelli d'Italia are in charge, Lazio fans do every annual... speaking of pilgrimages, we're arguing whether there's pilgrimages in Christianity. Lazio fans do pilgrimages to various fascist figures where they go to their grave and do the Roman salute. So like, there are pilgrimages in the Western world, just to football ultras who love guys like... died in Libya or whatever it is. You know, you're in the back of your head, you're like, did Senussi really win? Did Mukhtar really win? I mean, yeah, Libya got its independence, but Jesus Christ, look at it now. Look at Syria now. Like, the post-colonial world is fractured. The colonizing metropoles are re-emerging in various shades of, like, you know, the AfD winning in the elections, everything. You're like, we're back to the 1930s. We're back to 1929. We're back to fucking black shirts and brown shirts. Like, obviously, there's a hyperbole here. We haven't reached, you know, street fighting in Rome and street fighting in Munich yet. And the keyword here is yet. But, like... you know, you're watching the movie and it's supposed to be this glory, like the triumph of anti-colonial subject. But in the back of my head, I'm watching it and all I can think of is Operation Paperclip, Gladio, like all of these, like the Chapo does this where they call, I think Felix in particular does this, and I've become much more accepting of it, where he calls America the Fourth Reich. And I'm like, fucking, where are we now, really?
The film is a piece of propaganda, especially for Gaddafi, right? Who we now know what the end of Gaddafi was and what Libya looks like today, right? I mean, it's history repeats itself again, right? I mean, the Senussi order's back, baby. Cyrenaica's back. You might not like what that looks like now, as opposed to, you know, this beautiful vision of Omar Mukhtar and a revolutionary encounter colonial fight. What that looks like in the modern age, you might not be so akin to.
can either of y'all speak to what was the geopolitical situation of Libya at the time this was produced and released?
So when Gaddafi was releasing the message, he was in his pan-Islamic era. He has more eras than Taylor Swift. Respect. So he's got eras in him. When Lion of the Desert was released, Gaddafi has just started his turn to pan-Africanism, which he would continue into the 80s. He had some really harebrained ideas. Have any of you read The Green Book, by the way? It's hilarious. It's
not
awesome.
Not in its entire snippets, but...
In the 80s, he's going through pan-Africanism into the 90s a bit before he oscillates back to Islamism, and then 9/11 happens and he goes back to pan-Arabism. In the 80s, when Lion of the Desert is being filmed, he's really into his pan-African anti-colonial era. He starts wearing more Africanized clothing. He starts, because he got rejected by the Arab world, right? They're like, fuck off, you're useless. He has some really harebrained ideas in this period where he's like, we should do an African currency like the euro before the euro, but it should be pegged to oil. A famously stable commodity that has a famously stable price, and then he's like, we should have an African currency and an African Union, but not even like an African Union the way the European Union was. The way Gaddafi envisioned it was more like a confederation of like states under one federal army and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure Jonas Savimbi and Mobutu are going to accept you as the leader. I'm sure of it, pal.
Exactly. Those guys are all just going to get along and form one African state. Great, dude.
Yeah.
What if we all came together under one religion? Wouldn't that just solve everything? And it's like, wow, nobody's thought of that before.
I'm sure people like the Derg and Isaias Afwerki are really okay with sharing power with you. Yeah, no, but that's the context in which this movie is made, which is why also like they really don't touch on the Senussi's Sufi origins and their spiritual religious practices, because Gaddafi really wanted to hammer home an anti-colonial message. Like, for him, Omar Mukhtar is a Libyan hero, not a Senussi hero. Mm. He's a Libyan national hero. So, like, it's really emphasizes a nationalism that didn't quite... I mean, it was there, obviously. Like, this was the era of the colonial subjects achieving nationalism as a way to reject colonialism. But, like, it's really, really, really understates the influence of Senussiism as a mobilizing force for these people.
Do we want to talk about that? So we talked about the Quran, its importance, obviously, in Islam. I mean, it's the book. But the Quran is featured in a couple scenes in slight ways, right? The Quran of Ali's father is transferred to him, right, as a kind of rite of succession thing. So its importance to be carried and to be read by good Muslims is presumably kind of implied there. And then Mukhtar is shown... at the end of the film, praying, right, before his execution, he's shown reading and in the caves kind of hiding out. And their martial strategy is shown, you know, kind of closing his Quran and then thinking about war. But the role of religiosity is fairly diminutive. If we were going to tell a kind of more true to form story of Mukhtar, Amr, do you have a vision of what that looks like?
The most important religious scene in this movie, at least for me, you know, Amr, you may disagree with me on this. You know, they have to portray some of the Italians as one of the good ones. And that would be Raffaellone as Diodice, who I think I'm pronouncing that right, who was the general before Graziani, who...
He's the one that cries when he's executed.
Yeah, he
brings them water to pray.
Yeah, he's very moved by the honor of Al-Mukhtar, and he undoes his chains, he lets him pray...
to be in earnest, by the way, the only character that's interested in an actual peaceful solution to the conflict.
Yeah. Right?
Well, he's introduced as the guy who could make peace with the Bedouin with a handshake. Like that's in the party scene when Graziani first arrives, there's like a gala in his honor, and Diodice, or however you pronounce it, is introduced. There is the man who they say could make peace with the Bedouin with a handshake. And he's portrayed as a guy who's like, you know, the classic. He's very much portrayed in a Rommel-like way, very Rommel-esque, you know, as the guy who's interested in his enemies as people.
Yeah.
In terms of religiosity, I mean, like, it would have been historically accurate, but it would have been so cool in the movie if Diodice converts. Like, there's a scene where he's like praying in Islamic way. It would have been sick. If this was to be more true to the like religiosity as such, because the Senussis are a very It's complicated because they're a religious order. They're founded by the Grand Senussi in Mecca. The Grand Senussi being Algerian, who was a pilgrim in Mecca and founded this order, the Sufi order. But they're also, it's also a tribal and hereditary way where it's like, it's a particular tribes in Libya are Senussi and particular tribes are not. And when a Senussi, the head Senussi dies, another head Senussi takes over. And it's usually like a nephew or a son or whatever. And the king Idris the first, who's the king who was overthrown by Gaddafi, King Idris I became king of Libya in 1951, and he traces a direct lineage to the Grand Senussi who founded this order. So if this movie was to be accurate, it should portray Omar Mukhtar himself was a Senussi, but not the Grand Senussi. He was an imam, but he was a prominent figure. He wasn't the leader. He was preceded by Idris I as a military figure, but in terms of his role in the Senussi order, it's more of a spiritual leader as much as it is a military leader. And there would have been more focus on the Senussis as this entity that is equally religious and equally military order. Very much like the Knights of Hopitalier or the Templars, you know, in terms of like battlefield experience, but also devout focus on God.
I presume whenever we see Mukhtar, whenever there would be a scene opening, he would be leading a prayer, presumably, right? Or something of the like.
Yeah. Or carrying not just the Quran, but Senussi scripts as well. And like, you know, Senussi scripture. And you know, there should have been more scenes. I mean, obviously, they weren't going to do that because it's a Gaddafi financed film. There should have been more scenes where Mukhtar is going from village to village or tribe to tribe, not buying their loyalty, but attaining their loyalty through tribal pacts in which the Senussis offer like both religious consecration and military protection of the tribe in exchange for the tribe coming.
Because
into
of course
Senussi
it would
order.
Naturally be a religious element to the uniting of the tribes to form a resistance movement.
Yeah.
I think Gaddafi, you know, being a producer of this film, I think he had the foresight to know that, like, that's not going to make this effective propaganda. But he did, let's not forget, Gaddafi did actually get to actualize Mukhtar's final moment of revenge when he hired all those Italian models for a party. And instead of it actually being a party, he gave him the Quran, lectured them for an hour, and gave him a free copy of the Quran and the Green Book. So he, you know, he got his revenge on the Italian.
Yeah, they thought they were going to like a bunga bunga party, and he was like, "Let me instruct you in the way of the prophet."
Here's a question: what is if you're a woman who's like a model, and like your primary means of income is sex work of various kinds? Is it worse to suck Silvio Berlusconi off or to sit for 2 hours listening to Gaddafi lecture you about it?
I guarantee you, talking to Gaddafi takes a lot longer.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? If you're doing sex work for Berlusconi and his pals, you're like, right, 5-10 minutes, and then, you know, you dance a bit and then you fuck off.
I mean, you're going to be at a party. You're going to be drinking, presumably. There's going to be...
Yeah, that's the other thing. There's drinks available. There's drugs available. Whereas with Gaddafi, you're stone cold sober. There's not a single drop of booze. And he's telling you about how, like, you know, Islam prohibited the burial of women, infants, and the femicide was banned by Muhammad.
Sunday school ass party, dude.
Look, can y'all really quantify like how long it takes to find salvation? I think y'all are splitting hairs here. These women were saved. Is that what it's called? I know in Christianity it's called saved. What's it called?
What do you guys call that?
The funny thing is whenever you meet a convert, they call themselves a revert. And the reason for that is because Muslims believe that everyone is born a Muslim. When you're born an infant, you're born a Muslim. And then whatever your parents raise you as Christian or Jew or Buddhist or Hindu or whatever, you're straying from the righteous path. So if you convert as an adult to Islam, you're reverting back to the path you were born in as the righteous straight path. Okay. That's what converts say. I fucking hate it. It's one of my pet peeves. I just call it like conversion. You're picking one of whatever moral code you find most suitable.
Right. Do y'all have post-death baptisms like the Mormons do? Or is it like, okay, all right.
Neither, except probably while you're alive or you made the wrong choice.
Yeah.
Connor, did I ever tell you? I told Amr about talking to those Wahhabist teenagers online that try to convert everybody, and then trolling them by saying that, like, oh man, you're right. This Islam stuff sounds really good. I'm really interested in the history, but I think I'm going to convert to Shia Islam. And they're like, no, no.
it would be like if a Catholic tried to like convert you, and you're like, yeah, I agree. I think I'm going to be baptized in evangelical.
Yeah. Like, man, I met these born again guys, and I think I'm doing that. Yeah, it's highly heretical. Absolutely.
I think nowadays Catholic, it's like, don't proselytize. Don't try to convert anybody. Like, I don't think there's an active mission to convert people to Catholicism, is there?
Which is why evangelicism is winning, and like, you know, these evangelicals are going to places like Africa and South America and even like East Asia, and like, you know, former Catholic bastions like Brazil are just exploding with evangelical like fucking conflict.
Mexico too, enormous.
Yeah,
I mean, I would have never thought that, but we'll see. I mean, the Catholic vibe now is try to be normal, which for a guy who's not particularly religious, if I'm going to go to church, I really like that vibe, actually. I dig that vibe a lot, right? Yeah. Which is trying to be normal a bit for once.
Catholic to convert trad cats, as it were, as I understand it, are the freaky deaky ones that nobody wants to talk
those
to.
Those are internet guys. I don't think they go to church or like talk to anybody at church, because everybody will be like, what the fuck are you talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, but honestly, if you're a religion, right? Like, if you're a sect of a religion, like, what's the point of being a sect? If you have a Vatican behind you, fucking mobilize a Swiss guard, cut down some evangelicals. I know the Peace of Westphalia settled this question, but let's fucking get a good demonstration going again.
I want to see halberds. More halberds, please.
Yeah.
I don't think a halberd will stand up to an evangelical AR-15, of which they have so many.
Well, Swiss guard.
I was just envisioning a Brazilian mega pastor being thrown out of a window in Rio and like fucking starting another 30 years war. It would be so sick.
Now we're talking. want to talk some more about Lion in the Desert. So I mean, I just want to bring up, like I said before, I mean, the use of historical footage at the end of the film, right? If we're just going to talk about the propaganda,
historical props too. The props again, the fucking tanks and the bikes and the cars.
Incredible.
That shit is awesome.
If you want to see action scenes, watch this movie if just for that, right? There's I think a pretty interesting series of scenes and the general plot about the kind of antagonism, the face-off between Graziani and Mukhtar, which is interesting in its own right and has some good one-liners, but come on, these battle scenes just take the film to another level.
Well, hang on, Alec, I gotta ask, because you were talking about how some of the battle scenes and the message were cheesy. As a gun guy, were the battle scenes in this movie done well? All right, you're making a face.
So this suffers from Hollywood disease in certain ways. And look, if you're like a gun autist, and I at least used to be, I might still be, you know, now, you just, there's a level of forgiveness that you just have to have, right? Look, you know, the invaders from Mongolia being able to shoot their bows off of horseback at a gallop, right, is well known. If you've ever tried to shoot a rifle, you know, standing still, it's hard enough. Shooting it from a horse or just like hip firing it or whatever these guys are doing, not looking down the sights of your rifle and like one-shotting a dude in the forehead. Look, it's a film, right? We have to,
not looking down the sights, but like there's scenes where like they're holding the rifle without the stock in the shoulder. Like, the whole point of a stock is supposed to stabilize the rifle by putting it in your shoulders and the fucking recoil doesn't wallop your arms. And there's scenes where, like, they're holding it, like, this is an audio format, so it's kind of hard to describe, but, like, they're holding it, like, central. Like, they're just holding it the way you would hold, like, a fucking stick or a halberd. And they fire, and it hits the head, and I'm like, no way, come on.
There are extras in this that are familiar with the concept of a firearm, but probably have never seen a real one, and we're not given a real one, by the way.
You're also given different sound effects, like the foley of the gun being fired is very funny to me, because for the first half of the movie it sounds like a gunshot, and then the second half it starts to go beep. pew pew pew.
Yeah,
like, kind of metallic. You get, lazy. You get some of you start getting the editors using like the ricochet sound effects for actual just like gunshots. But look, there's so much to be delighted in as like a war nerd with this film.
I wanted to ask what you thought about on the Radio Warner side or the Warner side. I got annoyed because a lot of tanks were shown exploding for no reason whatsoever, and I get that. I get that Hollywood loves vehicle explosions, but like the Senussis famously didn't have artillery or like, you know, heavy weapons. So like, I don't think a rifle causes a tank to explode. I don't know. I'm not a tank guy, so I don't know.
I mean, you know, watch the Mythbusters about shooting a gas tank, right? Even that, which has been the mythical excuse in Hollywood for, yeah, why a tank explodes when you shoot it with a gun or something, or why a car explodes for no reason. It's, you just got to accept that it's movie magic, baby.
Yeah.
That part just... It's nice that there are tanks. I mean, some of the greatest scenes, I think, is the first battle scene in the desert when there's just armored cars like flying like Hot Wheels cars, you know, just like crashing.
They need to remake that scene. They need to remake that scene with the Yakety Sax theme song, because like it's just the Italians. If you want a movie that portrays the Italians as like the hapless oafs, barely human thinking, like just like tanks crashing into each other, people falling out of tanks for no reason against fucking guys on horseback. Like,
you just gotta embrace the spectacle. It's a beautiful circus, right? And by the way, not just the tanks, not just all the military hardware, the fucking horses, guys in full gallop, 20 at a time in a scene, right? Guys in full gallop kind of running towards a battle.
Yeah.
It looks great, right? Yeah. I'm tickled.
I was going to say on that Yakety Sack thing, what we need is a remake of Hogan's Heroes set in Libya. We need
the Senussi A-team.
Yeah, we need just like bumbling Italians and just like smooth-talking, charismatic Libyans just outsmarting them at every turn.
The way in which the Italians are portrayed is very, very like 80s bad, like 80s bad villains. Like, it's like Mr. Bean-esque. Jesus. Which, by the way, I thought that was a very interesting in contrast from the message, because the whole point of the message is to show the Muslims as underdogs and the Meccans as scarily effective, like very vicious and effective, which is where the torture scenes come, and then the battle of Uhud, the defeat of the Muslims. Whereas Akkad in Line of the Desert reverses that, whereby the Senussis are winning, essentially. You see like the Italians falling around everywhere. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't matter, because they're going to capture him and execute him anyway. Like, they're going to capture him on the star.
They're ruthless. They're well provisioned, yeah. Right? They
it's cheat, pure, right? Asymmetric warfare. For every tank that gets flipped, two more tanks land in ports in Benghazi. Planes are coming. Fucking, they show the planes, which I thought was interesting. Like the first case of aircraft.
A little bit of history. It might be during the Italo-Turkish War. I think the Italians take the cake for the first ever bombardment of civilians from the air. Of all time, I think in like 1912.
It was the first Italo-Abyssinian War.
Oh.
That was when they first used, there was the first registered use of mass bombardment of civilians from the air, and the first use of gas from the air. So dropping gas on civilians.
But yeah, I mean, the film goes to great lengths to show you that these are not your brave Senussi tribesmen. These are guys that cheat even by their own damn rules, right?
Yeah. And also, there's one scene that really stuck to me. It's not a battle scene. It's after when they first depopulate a village, and Omar al-Mukhtar, Anthony Quinn, shows up in the village with his pals, and he's like looking around, and he does this monologue where he's like, how can we fight such a war like this? Is it their fault? Or is it our fault for fighting this and bringing this on the innocent? He doesn't think about like innocent civilians, like they're dying. They don't get to choose. They just die. Like, you know, because he has that classic guerrilla thing of like, we chose this life. So if we die, we chose this. But innocent civilians, I'm doing air quotes, like they didn't choose this and they're still dying because the colonizer is killing them. But like, it goes back to something John often says in Radio Warner, which is like, if you choose a guerrilla, if you choose to be a guerrilla, you take a photo of your loved ones and you X out 9 out of every 10 faces, because that's what happened. If you're an insurgent, the counterinsurgency is, we'll kill your family. We'll kill your mom, your dad,
that's
your siblings, your kids.
To effectively do it, right? Is extermination. I mean,
the classic line, the Romans make a desert and call it peace. Is that scene really stuck to me? Because like, it's like,
he wouldn't often be asking that question. Yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't be asking that question, but I would be asking myself that question, because sometimes I think I'm like, if I was born in this or that period and I was missing that era, would I be a guerrilla fighter? And often I'm like, I'm okay with dying. I don't really care. I'm very much like in my mid-20s or mid-20s right now. So I'm like, I'm that pure Paul Atreides moment of like, I need to do jihad, right? But like, what would scare me would be the harm that would be entailed on my loved ones. Like, I'd be like, that would be terrifying, you know?
When they find out who you are. Yeah, I mean, that scene specifically, him asking himself that question, is another John Dolan thing, which is, if you're asking yourself questions and then answering them, just cut that part out of
writing,
you know?
The rhetorical question, not a good writing mechanism.
All right, so since we're getting near the end here, I definitely want to talk about the end of the film. This was the thing that made me tear up, made me want to rally for the Arab and African world. There is basically a sham trial for Mukhtar where, and maybe y'all can speak to this, but it seems that the Italian court is splitting hairs on, is Mukhtar a rebel or is Mukhtar a prisoner of war?
To go back to Alex's point about pointing out that the writer for both scripts is Harry Craig, an Irishman, famously, the big argument that made by the likes of Bobby Sands and other IRA members in British prisons is that they should be treated as prisoners of war, not as criminals within the British system, because they don't recognize the British system. And that IRA thing bled right through in that scene, the court scene with Omar Mukhtar. Okay. It was essentially rehashing the IRA question.
Wow. So this movie is definitely inspired and informed by Irish liberation.
Yes.
All right.
At least in that sense, yeah. Like, you know, if you're an anti-colonial fighter, it is in the best interest of the colonial forces to treat you as a criminal. Because if they treat you as a POW, they're legitimizing your resistance. Yes. They're recognizing that you are an equal. You're a belligerent in an equal war between two equal factions. And they must, eventually, they must negotiate with you as an equal. Whereas if you're a criminal, you're no better than like the local village rapist or like the fucking thief or whatever, right? Like,
critically, this is brought up earlier in the film where they want the Egyptian, they want outside oversight of negotiations.
Right.
And the Italians preempt them by saying, absolutely not. They're going to declare that they're a separate nation, that they're seeking nationhood. Absolutely, yeah. We will not involve anybody from the outside.
Because again, once you involve other countries from the outside, you're recognizing them as an entity to be negotiated with instead of a criminal, like, you know, this is just a gang, you know.
You don't ask outside support when you're doing police activity within your own country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fucking Egypt doesn't need to interfere if the U.S. is arresting, like, drug dealers or whatever, right?
And the pretext of the colonial projects are, this is Italy, right? Italian Libya is Italy.
Right.
Even more so than, like, the settler colonies of, like, North America are different, obviously. And then you have, like, the British Raj in India. That's different in the sense that the British Raj always had its own administration. Like Victoria was Empress of India, but, like, the British Raj was treated separately. The things that made French Algeria and Italian Libya so distinct, in a sense that both of them were seen as territories of the metropole. French Algeria, like the Pied Noirs, which are like the Algerians of French background, had representation in the French parliament. They were voted, like the MP from fucking, like, you're the member of parliament from Algiers, or, you know, or Oran. Similarly, like the Libyan, like, you know, if you're an Italian living in Benghazi during the Italian Libya, like, you're a citizen of Italy, you're a citizen of Rome, you're not... This isn't a British administrator in India being, like, you know, falling under the auspices of a separate administration. This is the soil. The soil is Italian soil.
I mean, I was just going to say, right, as a final feature, the genocide of the Libyans or the Senussi, you know, Bedouins, is a prominent, you know, propaganda point of the film. And an ending with the execution of Omar Mukhtar and the historical footage of, presumably filmed by the Italians, of the concentration camps of the Senussi, and just the vast expanse of tents in, like, wasteland desert. Pretty effective. I mean, like I said, I wasn't joking when I said this is like anti-Italian propaganda, or at the very least anti-Italian fascist propaganda. It's effective in that way, at the very least, right? These are some real bastards.
So one thing, you know, to bring it back to what maybe said Alec earlier, like, you know, putting this in the context of what's happening in Palestine right now, like when all of this stuff in Palestine, a lot of Zionists came out with that classic, like, well, the Nazis at least got really sad and drunk when they did their genocide, unlike Hamas, who are like evil for the sake of being evil. And like, to that point about lying in the desert, like the one guy who hesitates is shot by his soldiers. And like, that's fascism. That's Nazism as well. Like the Nazis on the Eastern Front weren't like the Zionists are like, oh, they were getting drunk and crying because of it. No, they're fucking patting each other on the back. They're like, well done, Heinrich. Well done, Adolf. This is great. Wonderful.
And critically to that point, I mean, the one guy who gives a shit and cries and treats Omar Mukhtar, you know, like a respectable warrior or whatever, it doesn't make a bit of difference.
Yeah.
What happens.
He's still hanged. He's still hanged. Yeah.
How respectful you treat your enemy. Not at all.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, so to come back to the message, Armor, I mean, Lion of the Desert, I don't know if it's still watched, if it's still important within, you know, I don't know, Libyan circles or Arab circles or North African circles. But the message critically is a very important film, right?
Yes.
You said it airs on state TV.
Yeah, so state satellite TV across the Gulf, at least. I don't know about the broader Middle East, but in the Gulf, there's like these state channels that show that are free. Everyone gets them, and they show like movie. There's one for movies, one for news, one for TV shows, and one for cartoons for kids. The movie one, every Eid al-Adha, which just came by. All the state TV channels show the message. It's kind of like I said earlier, I kind of made a joke, but it's not really a joke. It's our version of like how in Christmas, every TV channel shows like Christmas movies, like the fucking The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. The message is our version of that. Like state TV will show it every Eid. And I remember growing up, every year it'd be shown the Arabic version and the English version in different channels because there's an English movie and an Arabic movie channel. And they'd be shown and like, you know, they'd be in the background, people are doing all sorts of things. You'll see it in the TV in the background be shown. And it's just like, it has this cultural salience of like, I don't know if it still does with the younger generation. I haven't talked to any of my younger cousins about it, but like in my generation, at least, and previous generation, it's like, oh, it's Eid. It kind of like as necessary as like date cookies and lamb and rice dishes and your aunts and uncles giving you money is this message, the movie being played in the background. It's like a part of the ambiance. It's the cultural thing. Lion of the Desert, ironically enough, it doesn't really, I haven't met a lot of people who've watched it. Where it is popular is in indie movie circles. Like film friends of mine love it because it's like a hipster version of Battle of Algiers. It's like everyone knows Battle of Algiers, but you really know the real IPAs if you've watched Lion of the Desert.
Well, Battle of Algiers is in French. You ought to read subtitles. Even I know so many, you know, wannabe film nerds who hate reading subtitles, so they just don't watch films like that, which is a shame.
I'm a pure subtitles guy. I watch subtitles. I've had subtitles even with English movies. I need them.
I'm so I've had severe hearing loss my entire life, so I needed closed captions, and so my brain is automatically wired to I have subtitles on no matter what. So a foreign film, give it to me. I'm ready for Battle of
Algiers. You don't even have to try to pay attention to the lines, right? You can't understand them.
Yeah. Although I have to put my phone down. I cannot. I can't do two things at once.
That's the sickness.
My friend was arguing, like, we were trying to figure out, because I recently watched the anime Berserk. I don't know if you guys watched this.
I've only read it. I'm very caught up, but
Connor's our resident weeb. I only do the classic shit.
It was horrifying. I hate my friend for making me sit through that. It was fucking brutal. Right. But dub versus sub, I'm a sub guy through and through. I can't do dubbed. I can do subtitles, whether it's foreign languages or English language, but dub for me, the difference between the mouth moving and the voice, fucking, I can't do it. I can't. It throws me off.
I mean, even in anime, right, especially in anime, I'd say, the characterization through picking the voice actor, when it's just lost and the English voice actor sounds nothing like, right, the original, it's just such a bastardization, right? It's just so much is lost in translation just by mannerism and style.
I have to say, Amr, for some context, I used to work at basically a dubbing facility. Dubbing in anime used to only be done in Texas. And so I've worked for a company that takes great strides to like understand the cultural context of certain lines and certain characters. And they do make, I'm not saying they always do it, but they do make an effort to, like, let's find an American actor to match this character. And I have persona, to say, it comes down to the director. I've met directors that really give a shit, and I met directors who are like, this is a paycheck, like, it's just another slice of life bullshit, let's fucking go, let's get it over with,
get this out the door.
And I also have to say, you know, dubs put food on the table in my house, but I'm still a subs guy.
Okay, well, let's take one last moment to lament the Saladin film that Mustafa Akkad was working on whenever he died. He was killed actually in a bombing in Jordan.
Yeah.
In
2005, Amman bombings. Yeah, the same year the Kingdom of Heaven came out. But Al-Qaeda in Iraq took responsibility for these bombings. There were triple bombing of three hotels, which is why if you go to Jordan now, I went for a Model United Nations conference when I was a high schooler. All hotels we went to for MUN in Jordan, you go through like security, like as if you're going through an airport. There's like fucking the metal detectors and the fucking belt, and you put your bags through the belt because there was three hotels were targeted in Amman at the same time, and Akkad was killed in one of them. He was there to attend a wedding,
randomly, as I understand it.
I believe it was. There have been rumors that he was targeted because of the message. That those are all rumors to me. I don't believe them because I don't think that attackers knew he was there. I don't think it was a targeted thing. But yeah, it's random, and he died trying to raise funding for a biopic about Salah al-Din, which would have been so sick to see, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, maybe his spirit and ethos lives through Ridley Scott. We got to have you on to talk about more Islamic film in general, or stuff that you just like. You talk about your theory of the extended universe, the pantheon.
The Islamic cinematic universe, yes.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll do Kingdom of Heaven, and we'll do another two-parter of Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
Because I've talked about a Kingdom of Heaven as a propaganda film for Christians, but Amr has a different take on it.
It's a propaganda film for Muslims and a prophecy of the arrival of Obama. Baldwin is Obama. Baldwin is Obama.
Indeed.
Baldwin is Obama in the same way that Reynald and Guy are so like Cheney and Rumsfeld. They're like the oafs that are mismanaging the war. And if we only have a good technocrat who respects Muslims, Muslim coded himself, like Muslim adjacent, we'll get you know, a good war.
And according to some, Obama also was a leper of sorts. He's got that Kukri disease from like eating human flesh because they're drinking babies' blood and stuff all the time. If you follow, I've read
dogs. That's what I heard. I heard that he eats dogs. Like he.
I don't know about
humans, but I know the crank rumor is that he eats dogs.
I heard he gave this guy Larry Sinclair a bunch of drugs and made him suck his dick. So who knows?
he did coke with Larry Sinclair.
All right.
Well, let me be clear. If you like your jihad, you can keep it.
If you love it, you can keep him.
This character you're comparing him to in Kingdom of Heaven, did he say like, we owe a debt to Islam or anything like that?
Wait, I think almost.
Very close.
Actually,
very
close. Almost. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. He's a cuck. Baldwin's like a cuck lib.
Yeah. played by an actor who I'm sad doesn't get as many roles. Apparently, he's a nightmare to work with on set. Ed Norton. Ed Norton.
Wait, Edward Norton?
Yeah.
Yes, it's Edward Norton under this.
Edward Norton is notoriously difficult.
Yeah. He insisted on a mask, by the way. Initially, they were supposed to do makeup on him, and he's like, we want to get that silver mask.
Better. The mask is, I mean, that's one of the icons, right?
Yeah.
One of the people that incel tradcath guys on the internet can imagine themselves being, right?
Yeah. They all buy plastic version of the mask on Amazon and wear it when they do Twitch stream, which is awesome.
Oh my God. Okay. You have your Guy Fawkes masks and you have this mask, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, Amr.
All right, guys.
Thank you so much for doing this back-to-back marathon of podcasting. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You have to dedicate yourself to the craft of podcasting. We've been here for 4 hours.
Yeah. And for those listening, we are on Twitter at PropagandosPod. If we've had like kind of a jump in people listening and downloading, which thank you if you're still sticking around. I'm looking at the analytics. the math is math and everything's looking good. Random numbers, everything checks out. And please, if you have anything that you would like to say or recommend, love us or hate us, send us an email at propagandospod@gmail.com. And, you know, maybe we'll read whatever you have to say on the show or not. I don't know. We've never gotten an email before. We kind of want to see how this goes.
Don't tell them that.
If this show converts you to Islam, please send a message that you've converted reciting the Shahada, and we will repeat it in the show. Sorry, I'm hijacking your show.
We absolutely will retweet you if you've been converted by these. Yeah, go watch these movies, right? Yeah. They're free on, you know, quality may vary, but they're free on YouTube. And especially, I mean, at both of them. I was going to say, especially Lion of the Desert for the action scenes, but the message is compelling and interesting from a filmmaking standpoint. I mean, not having the main character be in the movie it will never be done again, I don't think, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right. On that note, thank you very much. And we'll see you next week.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.